Life magazine, and some of the others. We were trained to be researchers and reporters, and we knew we could never be writers because at Time Incorporated, only men were writers. The women were researchers and reporters, and we never thought to question that. That was in the late 50s, early 60s. And I think about it now, and it's just mind-boggling to me that I never questioned it. That was the way it was. If you look at some of the old television programs, Leave It to Beaver and those kinds of things, that was the mother. You wanted a nice house in the suburbs. You had to take care of the house. You had to fix good meals. You had to get the children to whatever activities they were involved in. I think at that point, I expected that that was the way it was supposed to be. However, I found after a couple of years of it that I was not satisfied. We were going to encourage our husbands to achieve great things. The thought was that we would get satisfaction and accomplish things by helping our husbands to succeed.
I think I had a very conventional upbringing, and I sort of assumed that I would marry, follow whatever my husband was doing, and raise a family. But I was enough my mother's daughter that I would think at times that there were things I wanted to do. And so I toyed with the idea, gee, it would be fun to be a lawyer. Gee, it would be fun to be a doctor. And that was one unconventional thing. I knew I wasn't going to be a secretary. And yet, when I look at my high school yearbook, almost every female in the class was either going to be a secretary, a nurse, or a teacher. And that was what we were being trained to do. We didn't have any other horizons. Teacher was at the top of that list, because if you were bright, then you would do that, and the doors would open. But in terms of the variety of things that women can choose to do now, we didn't have those choices until I got to high school. And I was very lucky that I had some role models who started pushing me to think about other things. One of the role models was my mother, who made it very clear that if she had her druthers, she'd be out working and I should be thinking in those lines also. And she was absolutely convinced that she could run a business better than the men in the family could, but they wouldn't let her. So, I started with an independent mother. I had two English teachers in high school, one as a freshman, one as a senior. The one as a freshman called my mother and father into school and said, not is Anne going to college, but she simply announced, Anne will go to college, and I believe she should go to Wellesley. That's the appropriate school for her. And it would not have occurred to me to question her. And it certainly didn't occur to my parents.
Wearily, it's merely a good woman's day, cooking and cleaning and tidying away. If ever you finish, remember that when you wake up tomorrow, it all starts again. We've got no union, it's 8 days a week. They're cramming seven, I'm out on my feet. So much to do, where should I begin? But I've got all my lifetime to finish it in.
For several of the women interviewed, the 1950s and 1960s were marked by ongoing efforts to confront racism and to improve the lives of those most affected by it. For African American women, racial discrimination as well as gender bias were daily realities.
This was as late as 1959 when we had gone back to Mississippi for the funeral of my husband's grandmother. And we were headed back to New York where we were stationed. And my husband had driven all night and we stopped to have breakfast at a roadside diner outside of Baltimore, Maryland. My sister-in-law and I went in to get food, use the bathroom. We were going to eat and purchase food to take to my husband that was sleeping in the car and the other children. We said, I'd like to order to eat in and so many to take out. And she said, you have to take them all out. I said, no, that's not what we want. We want to eat in and to take out. You have to take them all out. I said, oh, you mean we can't eat in here. We couldn't. So I said, well, my money is not good enough for me to eat in here. I won't purchase anything here.
When I first came, I drove down from Michigan. My car was packed with all of my goods, and I was staying in a hotel, and I was going to my classroom trying to get my things ready for school opening, and the principal made a habit of stopping in every day, and he said, well, where are you living, Millie? And I said, oh, I don't have a place to live yet. And he said, no problem. Lady across the street has small apartments, and you can rent an apartment from her. I know that she has one available. And he said, I'll take you across and introduce you to her. So he took me across and introduced me to her, and she smiled and nodded, and she said, come back later. I came back later without him, and she said, are you a Negro? And I said, yeah. And she said, I can't rent to you. She said, I have too many foreign students living here, and they wouldn't want to live around a Negro.
The difficult part was coming over here on campus and not having a place to eat, for instance, at noontime. There was a man named Palmisano, had a truck out here by Newman Hall, and he had apples and candy. And I used to buy a Mr. Good bar and an apple and take it into the library, to the women's restroom, to eat it, because there was no place on campus where we could go to eat at noontime. Another problem I had was an English teacher who, in seating the class, she called everybody's name alphabetically. And my name then was Scott. There was a friend of mine who was in the class. Her name was Barbie. And when she got to the B's, she passed on by her. When she got to the S's, she passed by me. The two of us were left standing while everybody else had been seated. And then she called our names and seated us alphabetically, B and S, together at the end of the room. I was upset about that. I went home and told my dad, and he went to Albert R. Lee, who was a clerk in the president's office. And he told him about it. And then Mr. Lee went on to the president. The president called in the head of the department, and the head of the department called in the teacher and talked to her about it. And then she called us in, and she gave some, well, they weren't very good excuses. They weren't good enough anyhow. I stayed in the class because I needed that course, and I managed to get a decent grade out of it.
No mouths of violence out of hate shall turn me from my goal. No Jim Crow law or police state shall stop my freebound soul. 5,000 people bound in jail, lift our heads and sing. We'll travel on to freedom like songbirds on the wing. Heed the call.
Heed the call, American soul.
Amidst the racism that was prevalent in the Champaign-Urbana community, some women chose to take a stand. For example, one woman decided to do something about the lack of a full-time daycare center that would admit African-American children.
There wasn't a daycare for black kids. And so my mother-in-law said, why don't we, you know, have a daycare? And my husband said, no, you're not going to work. You should be very grateful that you don't have to work. So I didn't have anything to do. We just built a new house. And we bought a new car, and he said I didn't have to work. But my mother-in-law kind of wanted it. We came back to Champaign, and my husband said, no, you're not going to do that. I want you, you know, to be at home. So I walked home from Westside Park, and I told my husband I was pregnant. Now, he's the only one with the income coming in. So he said, well, why don't you just continue getting your daycare together, and he said that when you have the daycare, we'll get a babysitter and you can still have the daycare. So we kept working at it. So Yvette was born 2 days after Christmas, and I opened up the daycare April. I had a classroom, I had a big room for them to play, and the kitchen, and then there was the bathroom.
In the nation's eye, the women's rights movement regained momentum in the 1960s. The success of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, first published in 1963, is often seen as an event that marked the beginning of the second wave of the women's rights movement. Friedan wrote about the role of full-time homemakers and encouraged women to find ways to engage with the broader world. The feminine mystique impacted the lives of many women.
A lot of these things were making people more aware of what's really happening to women. And a lot of times, because of it, there were a lot of divorces. People started thinking, well, I can do my own thing. There were so many things at the time that we did stop and think for a long time. You didn't think about it. You'd figure that was the way that was, even though I suppose it did change some of my thinking. There were so many of us who didn't realize how much we were discriminated against. People didn't know that there was discrimination. You accepted what your life was like. And so there were many people then who said, I don't like this. I don't want to be this way. They were saying that we're not treated right, and they were trying to get more equality. And in so doing, sometimes they were very brash, and some of the men didn't know what to do about it, and some of them didn't seem to grow with it, you know, and say, okay, look at us. We should all be equal.
Reading their work made me rethink a lot of the assumptions about gender that I've been raised with. And this is what they did for many women, was we tried to rethink the logic of the roles that we believe belong to us. Why is it that women are supposed to be the primary caregivers? Why is it that they are the ones who are responsible for domestic work? What is there about that that has to be an inexorable law? There is nothing. It's not been the same throughout history and throughout culture. It was just that particular time period where that model of family and that model of raising children was widely accepted as the correct or the best way to do that. Reading their work was another way of coming to terms with what I sort of already knew, which was that it's not fair that one particular gender has to take on all that work while the other one has more choices. They're making more money, they have more power, they're making the decisions about what happens in government and education and our other institutions, and women are not having a voice in those decisions. It's a very simple matter of equity. That's what feminism is. It's just a matter of men and women being treated equally and having equal say in the governance of their particular society. That seems like common sense, but somehow wasn't back then, and it needed to be said.
The second wave was also marked by other legislative achievements. Under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, it had been illegal since 1964 to discriminate on the basis of gender in the workplace. However, it was not until feminist organizations, such as NOW, pushed the issue that the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission began to take seriously the thousands of complaints of gender bias they received. In 1972, Title IX of the Educational Amendments was passed, forbidding exclusion on the basis of gender from any federally financed educational program, including athletics. While all these developments made people more aware of sexism, many still had to fight gender discrimination in their everyday lives.
I needed a job, and it so happened that Standard Oil New Jersey, now called Exxon, was opening an international section and was hiring economists. And while it was never my ambition to work for a big oil company, it was otherwise a good job, and I took it for the time being. And it so happened that there were three women there from Chicago and four or five guys from Harvard. And we used to have some lively discussion. One of the Harvard guys one day said to me, I don't see how we can study in the library when there are women around. It's too distracting. And I said, well, people manage to study at Chicago. And he said, that's because the women at Chicago are dogs. They apparently thought that if there were women around, they couldn't concentrate on their work.
I was director, and they decided to hire a man. And I thought, you know, it's fine, because then he will take care of the boys' program, I'll take care of the girls, and it'll be less work for me. So after he got there, I discovered that I was not only being his secretary, but I was still the disciplinarian, and they took part of my salary to pay him. And that's when I decided it's time for me to go, because I thought it would be a pretty bad example for me to give to my children that I would let somebody treat me like that.
I became a principal over at a school that's now closed called Weber School. I had prepared, I was ready, and then this position opened up. This was a man who, he was an intern administrator, and he got a job sometime in September, so he left. And here was the school without a principal. and I had all my credentials, and I was encouraged to apply. I applied, and I was selected. And I went over there very proudly, and I remember I walked into this office, and I was very excited. There's a knock, and this lady stuck her head in, and she was smaller than I was, and she said, "I just wanted to introduce myself." And I said, "Well, welcome." And she looked me up and down, and she said, "Well, you know, we're used to men around here as principals. You think you can handle these boys?" And I smiled, and I thought, "Okay, bring it on." I had to overcome a lot of, no other word for it, prejudice, but we got along just fine because I think in the end, everybody wants to work together and we all want to educate the children. It was not staff and all, it was just some of the neighborhood people weren't sure about me. I wasn't a man. I wasn't 6 feet tall and I'm African American.
Well, every legislator, woman or man, has a lot of obstacles to overcome. I don't know that there was a particular feeling that I was having a more difficult time as a woman than I would have if I had been a man. But some of the men in the legislature were not all that happy to have more women come in. I do remember once after I had been in office for several months, and thought that everybody else who was in the legislature knew who I was. I was sitting behind my desk after we'd been on the House floor back in my office. And I saw this man come past my door and kind of do a double take and come back again. And our names were on the door, so he could easily tell who I was. And when he saw me looking up and recognizing him, he said, "Oh, you're a legislator. Here's a male legislator saying this to me." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I've seen you on the House floor, but I assumed you were somebody's secretary." And so even after being in there a few months, I obviously was not that well known by all of my male colleagues. Not only was I not known, but I was misplaced because the assumption was that the women who might circulate on the House floor were secretaries rather than members of the legislature. That changed a lot after a few more years of exposure to more women in the legislature.
Throughout the 20th century, the women's rights movement was also concerned with women's reproductive health and freedoms. In 1916, Margaret Sanger, a nurse, had opened the United States' first birth control clinic in Brooklyn. At the time, it was illegal for anyone other than a doctor to distribute information about birth control, and they could only do so in limited cases. Although Sanger was soon arrested and spent some time in prison for her efforts, she was not discouraged. In 1921, Sanger founded the American Birth Control League, which would later become Planned Parenthood, an organization that works to distribute information on contraception and to legalize what they were doing in the eyes of the government. In the 1960s, Sanger actively supported research leading to the invention of an oral contraceptive and traveled internationally promoting it. Sanger's dedication gave many women more control over their reproductive choices. The next step was Roe v. Wade, a case brought to the Supreme Court in 1973 regarding a woman's right to have an abortion. The court decided that under the principles of the U.S. Constitution, a woman had the right to get an abortion for any reason whatsoever, as long as it took place within the first trimester of the pregnancy. This decision was life-changing because it gave women seeking an abortion access to proper medical care rather than forcing them to turn to risky underground operations.
When I was in high school, the fear of getting pregnant terrified all the girls. Every year, a handful of girls would drop out of school and they would have to get married because they were pregnant. Again, this is a small town where everyone knows everyone else. This is a time period where being pregnant before you're married is considered sort of immoral or socially disgraceful because there were no other choices, really. I mean, you could put the baby up for adoption. But again, in a small town, I never knew anybody who did that because everybody already knew you'd gotten pregnant. All you could do to save yourself, to save your reputation, was to get married. And we weren't allowed to go to school if we were pregnant. You couldn't go when you were showing. So sometimes the father, the boy, could finish high school, but the girls never did. That was the end of their education. And it didn't always seem like a tragedy to some people, because that's what girls were supposed to do anyway, was to get married and have children. But of course, as you can imagine, a lot of these marriages didn't last. I mean, they were just children when they were married, and they weren't prepared for the responsibility, and they really didn't know even who they were yet. So when Roe versus Wade was enacted in 1973, I was a junior in high school. Suddenly, that made another option for us. We actually had another choice we could make about what to do if we got pregnant. There was also the birth control pill, but again, we're young teenagers in a small town and don't really have access to that without having to tell our parents or something like that. And so we're not going to do that because we're not supposed to be having sex. So we were just really limited by the choices that we had at that point.
Not only were women gaining more reproductive rights, but services and shelters soon became available for women who needed a place to stay when confronted with abuse, rape, and homelessness. One of the first such organizations in the U.S. was created in 1971 in Urbana and came to be known as a Woman's Fund.
I always want to give credit to a woman named Jackie Flinner, whose husband had died and she had insurance and was going to buy a house. And she decided that she would buy a house that she could share as a shelter, and got involved a number of us women to be a kind of support group around that. We tried to get the word out to other agencies, social workers. The first woman that came to the shelter, I got a call, could I come over? Because I was a volunteer. So I went over, and it was a young African-American woman whose boyfriend had broken her jaw, and so her face was all wired. She goes to the hospital, they wire her jaw, and then they just let her go with no place to go. I mean, I don't know if she could have gone back to her boyfriend. So there she was at a woman's place, and I went over to talk to her and see what we could come up with. And I thought, this poor woman, her eyes just looked huge. But we got her to the state's attorney the next day so she could file orders against him. And then what happened is that other women who didn't want the shelter, they would come just to meet too, and usually because they had a problem. In those days, it was very popular to have group therapy. Sensitivity groups were very popular. We didn't realize it, but in a sense that this support group was sort of like our sensitivity group, because everybody would share experiences, and realizing that the experiences may be on a continuum. I mean, it may be a little thing and it may be a big thing, but it really is all on the line of inequality.
When you have a drunk and the two kids, somebody still has to bring home bread because he wasn't going to be able to work. He's drunk. My kids need to be in school. So I, you know, superwoman, decided to try to save everything. And so we ended up homeless. And I remember having to move everything out, and I was throwing away stuff. And I went to a friend's house, and then she was going through a divorce. It's like 3 months, and we were homeless, living out of motel rooms, putting my girls in different schools, because whatever hotel we were at was where the kids were going to go to school and stuff like that. Well, I came to Champaign and found the Center for Women in Transition, which was one of the most awesomest places in the whole wide world, because I was able to recognize that I was still making really bad decisions based on self. And if you don't have a good foundation of self, which I really didn't have a good foundation of who I am, and it's also a control issue. I felt like my life was out of control. I did not like the person in the mirror that I saw. I was starting to notice body image a lot. I didn't like how I felt. I got made fun of a lot because I was overweight. But I was noticing that I wasn't getting a lot of boys to pay attention to me. So between like 13 and 14, I did what they call bulimia. So I went from like 160 pounds to like 90 pounds in the summer. If I recollect, I was very, very much food obsessive during that time. So I really wasn't thinking about goals. I was totally internalizing a lot of different feelings.
I think in many ways that in high school, for me, that girls are kind of seen as conquests or objects and that we're not taken as seriously. The only way I could feel a part of was to start drinking, you know, for me. No one really gave me a good sense of womanhood. I didn't really know what being a woman was all about or what the whole linguistics of being a female. But I think I was treated more unfairly because I was a drunk and a bulimic.
One of the major battles of the second wave involved the proposed Equal Rights Amendment, or ERA. Efforts to pass a constitutional amendment stating that citizens had equal rights under all parts of the law, regardless of gender, had begun in 1923, when the National Woman's Party, led by Alice Stokes Paul, had introduced it to Congress. The ERA did not pass in 1923, and it was reintroduced every year until the 1970s. In 1972, the amendment was finally approved by both houses of Congress and went to the states for ratification. Groups on both sides of the issue became so involved that Congress granted an extension of the ratification period. However, when time ran out in 1982, only 35 of the 38 states needed had ratified the amendment. Although pro-ERA forces had campaigned heavily in Illinois, the state legislature never approved the amendment. For many, the promise of full equality offered by the ERA exemplified the hopes of the second wave.
We were fighting for the Equal Rights Amendment. I helped organize a march to the courthouse in Springfield, and I marched with my best friend, her mother, and her grandmother, and it was just phenomenal. At that time, there was a group of women from this very community who chained themselves inside the Capitol Rotunda. It was just really a phenomenal time. It makes me feel a sense of something that's bigger than me and seeing that there are a lot of people united in this war.
I just thought it was so ridiculous that they weren't willing to say that women had equal rights. And I have a friend, she still wants to get those three more states. We'd gone to Springfield and marched for it and tried to get people to see that it was an important thing to do.
Women ought to be equal citizens with men in every respect. And although we have been able to attain many of the same things by other routes than getting the amendment to the federal constitution, I think it would still be a good symbol for us to have it a part of the federal constitution. What we did in Illinois, some of the women actually had legislation drafted by the Reference Bureau, which is the normal process, to find any place in the laws that seemed to be discriminatory and to change that to neutral language so that instead of it applying just to men, it applied to men and women equally. There were a whole series of bills introduced to do those changes. Most of them did not pass the first time they were introduced. The men would not support them, by and large. The next session of the legislature, the women who had sponsored those bills earlier got men to sponsor the bills, and most of them passed. No changes as far as the substance was concerned, but the sponsorship made a big difference in that regard. I just feel that even though at this point, there are not a lot of ways in which women are legally discriminated against. Attitudes still have to change in order to make things totally equal.
Faced with calls for action from various reform movements, some African American women found it hard at times to support both the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. Instead, they chose to fight racism and to stand by African American men rather than confronting gender bias.
My concern was more about black men than women's rights. I don't know that I worried about women's rights. It was our men that needed their rights. They didn't have the rights that they should have. That isn't something that has bothered me, and I don't know whether that's true of very many women or not. Now, today, I know it's different. I would not want to work the same job as a man worked and not get the same amount of money. That part I can see. But, you know, a lot of our men are in prison and don't have the kind of jobs that others have.
The women's movement at that time did not address a lot of concerns of women because we sort of grouped women all together and assumed we had all the same experiences, and that, of course, was not true. the women's movement really failed at that particular time period in the 60s and 70s to address the issues and concerns of African-American women, for instance, Latino women, other women of color, poor and working class women. These women, they didn't need to escape from the domestic world. They were already out there working. Their problem was that they weren't making enough to survive, or they didn't have a choice whether to work or to stay home. So all those things came about over the years that feminism had to realize that one of the most important things was to address all the differences among women, as well as their common experiences, and that women's experiences are different across histories and across different cultures.
Some believe that we are now in the midst of a third wave in the women's rights movement, as women have continued to overcome barriers. Although there has been continued momentum during this time, there has also been resistance to new ideas about gender roles, not just from men, but also from some women.
I worked for a while writing for a zine called Pandora's Rag. We billed ourselves as U of I's premier feminist zine. We were also U of I's only feminist zine, so we could call ourselves whatever we wanted. But the zine covered a lot of different issues relevant to college students, but also relevant to our own experiences and broader society. I remember bringing it home and trying to give a copy to my brother and sister to say, hey, I'm really proud of being an editor for this and writing for this. I'd like you to see it, to read it. And my siblings must have left it out on the table. And this was after, in college, at some point, your bed gets taken away, and so you sleep on the couch or you sleep someplace else. And I woke up with my mom in my face with the copy of Pandora's Rag saying, do I bring hate speech into your house? Do I bring things that are hateful into your house? This is like a letter from the KKK. Would I bring a letter from the KKK into your house? I'm groggy and I'm just trying to wake up and I'm not sure what's going on. And I come to realize that she's so offended by this idea, and also feeling personally that the magazine was angry about her choice to stay at home and parent us. I think that's what her take on feminism was, that she felt like I was bringing hateful words into her house. So there wasn't really room for those other points of view, that was just really seen as hateful.
One area of ongoing advocacy concerns women's safety in public. As early as 1877, women in London marched informally to publicize their fear of violence in the streets at night. In 1978, the modern movement, known in the U.S. as Take Back the Night, was created to help end sexual assault and violence towards women. Take Back the Night helps groups organize marches and candlelight vigils, often through universities, including the University of Illinois. While historically, only women were encouraged to participate in these events, in recent years, the movement has been open and welcoming to men, increasing awareness of gender-related violence.
The Take Back the Night march, it's a march to end sexual violence, but it's almost more like performance art than a typical protest. I mean, the idea is women are going to walk the streets safely for one night. And so after dark, it'd be a women-only march, there'd be these huge crowds of women just like walking through all the neighborhoods where they don't generally feel safe. And then they would meet up with members of both genders for like this, it's hard to even describe it. It would be testimonials, people kind of coming and just talking about their experiences with sexual abuse and sexual violence. And there was a sexist trash can where sexist trash would be set afire and burned. And there was a good deal of humor and theater to it. But I mean, sitting through these testimonials was cathartic. It was devastating. I mean, you'd come home and you're just like, there are just so many stories. It seems as if like every single woman you see can walk up and tell some story about some horrific experience with a boyfriend or a stranger or a male relative or a teacher. You'd hear story after story. And on the one hand, like, oh, this is really good. I have a new consciousness now, a new awareness of this as an important reality. And at the same time, it's just your gut is in knots afterward. It's just terrible and you feel so hopeless. And as a man standing there listening to all of this, you just feel like, what can you do? Year round, I just had this sense of physical danger surrounding otherwise very strong, independent women. And this just drove me crazy.
The first time he lifted his hand against me, he knew the blow was wicked. Put his arms round me, said he was sorry, sorry, love, sorry, all the night long. The next time he lifted his fist against me, I thought I'd provoked him, I was to blame. The next time
Many universities have created units devoted specifically to ensuring women's well-being on campus. The University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign has an Office of Women's Programs that works with individuals and groups to make them more aware of gender bias, sexual harassment, assault, and other issues that impact women and how to cope with them.
I think that it's helped some students stay in school. I think it's helped some students get back into school. I think it created a safer campus community, one that's more responsive to the individual needs of students, more supportive. And I think it's helped those individuals who are close to someone who's been affected by these issues, knowing where to get support for themselves so that they can help their friend. I think it's been instrumental for professors and instructors who have a student disclose to them, "I'm being beat up by my boyfriend," that they know where they can send that person. They know someone that that individual can talk to. And we've created leadership opportunities for students as well. The students who work for us go on and make impacts in their own communities.
One of the interesting things that I get to do in my job right now is teach a class that's just for men in fraternities. And it trains them to be peer educators to their own chapters around sexual violence. Some of my guys in the class went to a game in Ohio, went to a football game, and they were in the apartment of some female friends of theirs that they were staying with. And they'd been drinking. It was 3 a.m, and the boyfriend, who was from Ohio State, of one of the women who lived there, started yelling and screaming at her, grabbed her, threw her up against the wall, and started like pounding the wall next to her head and like yelling threats at her. She was crying. These two guys, who are both in my class, say they look at each other and they think, well, somebody else should do something, somebody from here. And sure enough, a guy from Ohio State kind of goes up and says, "Hey, let go of her." And the angry boyfriend turns around and punches him. And this is how they're telling this to me in class. They said, "So, we did what you told us to do. I threw him down on the chair and started choking him. And the other guy grabs another chair and holds it above his head so that if he should get away, they can bring it down crashing upon his head." And I'm sitting here thinking, I in no way, shape, or form told you to choke people as like a way to intervene. You know, but I'm listening to this and they're like, and then she got upset and so we let go of him and he ran outside and then started calling death threats into his girlfriend on her cell phone. And so they said, you know, she was really upset, so we played a drinking game with her. And so they played some sort of a card drinking game with her to like help her calm down. And they're like, so then she went to sleep. And then her roommates start saying, you know, "I don't know why she puts up with that. It's all her fault that this stuff happens. You know, she's to blame for it." You know, this is 4 or 5 a.m, maybe. I can't imagine they were in a very good state. But they said, so we kind of tried to talk with them about what she needs from them and how they could support her and giving them these kind of good skills to help out. And the next morning when they got up and they were eating breakfast, they talked with their friends again about ways that they can best support her and what she's going through and helping them understand what an abusive relationship's dynamics are like.
Could you talk about your wife? Has she influenced your work in any way?
Actually, in a really big way. I can't be out there as some sort of like rogue guy who's just doing things on my own. I need to check in with women to make sure that this stuff's working. And she and I talk a lot about some of the work that I do. So I go home and tell Anita, "Can you believe what happened? They started choking people and saying that I told them to choke people and I never told them to choke people." And she said, "You know what? You would never have been in that room. That's not your space. They were someplace where you could have never have been." And they intervened. Like, they stopped the violence from happening. They talked with her roommates about what they could do. They tried to provide her some emotional support in the best way that they could at that moment. You know, and it just made me stop and think and realize, given what they had to work with, that's actually a pretty amazing thing to do. And it also leads me to an idea that I always think of, that just social change is really messy. So I always want things to look really pretty and to be these like really beautiful interventions where everybody smiles at the end. But it just is kind of stinky and yucky and messy. And I think that's what Anita helps me to see. She helps me to see through all that stink and see what the good stuff is.
In recent years, state and federal laws have been passed to help protect women from abuse. These laws have helped codify societal changes brought on by the women's rights movement.
One is a tenancy law where if someone is, let's say, sexually assaulted in their apartment and they don't feel safe living there anymore, we now have a law that says landlords have to let that individual out of their lease. Before, I can't tell you how many students I've worked with over the years trying to get their landlords to release them from their contracts when something has happened, and it's been impossible. So now there's a law that says they have to. Another one is an order of protection. In the past, if a student was sexually assaulted by another student, they didn't have an order of protection available to them. As of about 2 years ago, they do. So they can go to the court, and the court can issue an order that tells that other person, you will have no contact whatsoever with this individual. And they'll enforce it through police and charges.
We will not stop. We will not go away. We will not stop.
While there has been great progress regarding opportunities for women and men, many expressed a wide range of opinions on how far our society has come with respect to gender equity.
I like for people to realize, though, that we have come so far in my lifetime. I mean, things are so much better for women than they were. Maybe I've been conditioned not to want to go higher. I think, though, that the attitudes that I experienced with my daughters growing up and then seeing their attitudes aren't necessarily true of the general population. And I think it's not necessarily inequality, but in a way, women's expectations of themselves. I think maybe not all high school girls in this country aspire to have the things I wish they would have, if you know what I mean. It's more in terms of attitudes that I think are still not as equal as they could be.
I think that as men, we oftentimes, because it's not the world we lived in, we don't get a chance to think about what ways would our lives be dramatically improved if we weren't benefiting from these privileges. If sexual and domestic violence weren't happening, which is one of the ways that I see that inequality is continuing, then that would be our loved ones that wouldn't be hurt. You know, that would be the women we care about not being hurt. And so that would improve our lives as men. But I also think about the ways that it would improve our relationships with all women, and it would improve our relationships with men as well. One of the quotes that I always think about is Paulo Freire says that the oppressor in dehumanizing the oppressed is himself dehumanized. So that when a group of people say, you are not as good as I am, then you also are dehumanizing yourself at the same time, because you're saying you're all worse and I'm all better, but it's not giving you a chance to say, what are all the qualities I'm shutting off from myself? What's all the empathy that I have to kill off for myself so I can be okay with the way these groups of people are being treated? And I think that that death of empathy is a really important thing that we have to work to rebuild. You know, it's my personal belief as an educator that these things have all been learned, so they can be unlearned, so they can, we can learn new things. We don't have to be stuck in this one way of being. Education can help produce change.
Women are much more likely to live in poverty. And part of that is that we as women are much more likely to have custody and care for children. We're also much more likely to provide for the care of aging parents. So all of those things, I think, impact women's ability to earn a living and keep those dollars. We're much more likely to work within the service industry where health insurance isn't even available. So all of those things, I think, show that women still have a way to come, certainly in our country, but even more so when we look globally.
Think to young people coming up today, like girls your age, it's like, what do I want to be? It's not what can I be and let me try to fit myself to that somehow. It's an enormous range of options. Sports is just one good example where the field is just different to a girl coming up today who's athletic and wants to be in sports. Again, it wasn't unheard of when I was a kid, but it's far more just natural and encouraged now. Like, of course you would. Why wouldn't you? the most significant ways it's changed, I think I will just have to stay with that kind of broad answer. I think there is just, you know, our society's becoming more flexible, slowly but surely, and that's a good thing. We're moving more towards, and when I say androgyny, I just mean that sense of we don't have rigid, this is appropriate for men, this is appropriate for women, let's put a very thick dividing line between those. I think we're just much more comfortable with the idea that very, very masculine men, there are much less masculine men, there are very masculine women, there are much less masculine women, and there's just this long continuum.
There has been progress, but not as much as a lot of people think. If you look, for instance, in academia, more than half undergraduates now are women, but they're still segregated by field considerably. And lo and behold, the fields where they're mostly men are high pay, and the fields where they're mostly women are low pay. Nurses, for instance, are miserably paid.
I think that change in terms of gender equity is not going to happen until it becomes part of our daily lives. And I think one of the most important ways to do that is to address it within the family, in the home itself. So one of the things that my husband and I did was to always model what an equitable household should look like. And we didn't do it perfectly, obviously. When I was in graduate school, he actually did much more work. When he was in graduate school, I did much more work. But our children did see that we shared the child care, we shared the domestic work, and I think that does change things. My son is married now, he has a 3-year-old, and he does do his share of child care and work in the house. In fact, if you ask my grandson who the vacuum belongs to, it's his father. One more thing I would say in terms of progress about women is that one problem that continues to be an almost epidemic level is violence against women and domestic violence. This is something that I grew up with, so I feel strongly about it, even though I was not a victim or a survivor myself. And I think women have done a lot to try to address that problem in many different ways. We now have shelters. We have, here in town, women in transition. We have rape crisis centers, but all those things are sort of responses to the way things are. And what I really would like to see is real change. This is why I think it's so important to have men in gender and women's studies and have men taking these classes, because I don't think it's going to change until we change the way men think about masculinity and themselves, the way they think about women. Until we address that in the culture at large, I think it will continue to be a problem. And this is, again, why I put so much emphasis on what happens in the home, what happens in the family, because I think that's the place to begin teaching respect for women. That's one area.
I'm not sure how you get through to a younger generation of women which take their status and their rights for granted, and they don't know how much work it took for each and every change that they now assume it's nothing at all. And there are some things that we romanticize and we think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to live that way? But the reality of living that way was very different. And the reality of being infantilized and made into a child because you happen to be female, that's not something that I think would please too many women nowadays, if they were suddenly put back into that world. So I don't know. I think that young women should be a lot more alert to what they risk giving up. And it's not a question. I mean, it's easy to pull out the question of abortion. That's not the question. The question is getting women to the point where they have the right to decide what kind of lives they're going to lead. And then the next part of it is to make sure that they make appropriate decisions and wise decisions. And to do that, you need to have information. You need to have education. And I think that's basic.
As people began to realize individuals had rights, I think women said, well, yeah, I have some rights too. I am an individual. I'm not an appendage. I can do certain things as well. I think women have always known how capable they are. We just didn't have the opportunity. it's very difficult for people to handle change. But I think as they keep pushing and the institutions keep giving, you get a little closer together.
Somehow, women got redefined and got accustomed to tagging behind, got used to living by manners and graces and being judged by our figures and faces. And before long, you were peeling our bananas, opening doors for us and moving our pianos. Then you got busy. You had a ball, making, breaking, and rearranging it all. You're up there in the driver's seat, and we're down here with a balance sheet. We're answering a question you didn't ask. We want to go forward into a past where humans were part of a natural whole. So, forward to the past with attitude, and backward to the future with gratitude for the battles our foremothers fought and won, for the battles we're winning one by one. You men out there, it's a time of change, of redirection, and it does feel strange. It'll get less so hour by hour, but remember, it isn't easy relinquishing power.
I am woman, watch me grow, see me standing toe to toe, as I spread my loving arms across the land. But I'm still an embryo, with a long, long way to go, until I make my brother understand.
We hope you have enjoyed Rethinking Assumptions, the quest for gender equity in East Central Illinois. This program was produced by University of Laboratory High School students Jenny Cook, Amalia Dolan, Alex Ingalls, Catherine Flos, Maria Gao, Ashwarya Gautam, Sheila Gogola, Christina Hardin, Rachel Harmon, Hadley Hauser, Sarah Heffley, Amanda Hu, Adam Joseph, Zach Coral Gold, Revathi Maturi, and Marina Shaw. Executive producers were Linda Lee and Maritza Mestre. Ruth Welch conceived of and initiated the project. Assistance with background research was provided by Anna Rubikina, Shruti Vaidya, and Sarah Joyaki.
Interviews were conducted by members of the University Laboratory High School Class of 2012. Our interviewees included Irma Bridgewater, Anne Einhorn, Mary Ann Ferber, Kathy Garner, Rosetta Gray, Jackie Kahn, Matt Mitchell, Pat Morey, Millie Ransom, Helen Satterthwaite, Bernadine Stake, Cecile Steinberg, Shirley Stillinger, Ross Wantlin, and Ruby Weathersby. For more information on this project, visit our website at will.illinois.edu. This program was directed by Dave Dickey of Illinois Public Media and University Laboratory High School teacher Janet Morford. I'm Linda Lee.
And I'm Maritza Mestre.
Gas is almost $4 a gallon. It could be the dawn of peak oil, when the world's oil supply peaks and then begins to decline.
People simply don't realize the scale of the problem, the length of time, and the amount of money involved.
I'm Barbara Bogave. Join me as we hear from scientists pioneering alternative fuels to keep us running if the new energy crisis arrives. After Oil, from the Purdue University College of Engineering.
Friday afternoon at 1.
The holiday weekend forecast calls for mostly sunny skies today with a high of 82. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight. Locally heavy rainfall possible, the low 62. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms in the morning. A chance of showers in the afternoon, the high 72. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night, the low around 60. Mostly sunny Sunday with a high around 82 degrees. Sunday night through Thursday, partly cloudy skies. Lows around 62, highs around 85. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.